Next, we go to Colorado, where hydrofracking has been in progress for several years now. We'll hear the testimony of a diverse array of people captured in the documentary Rural Impact.
The gas and oil business does not know what planning means. Not to a community, not to people, citizens. They make their plan and they bring it to you and they say, this is what we're going to do. You have 30 days to adjust.
They are just having no consideration for the people who live here. We are expendable.
And a lot of issues are related to the fact that people living on properties didn't control the mineral interests below. Oftentimes didn't realize that somebody could come in and draw on their land and had the access to the, or the right to access the minerals below.
Every gas well that gets drilled has an ancillary number of things that are associated with it, truck traffic.
And so every well they drill means 200 to 300 trucks during the life of the drilling of that well.
Air pollution, water pollution, or the chance of water pollution.
Social issues, economic issues, the infrastructure is not keeping up, the population is growing, and a lot of these folks who come in are very transient folks. You know, they go where the next boom is.
They make a lot of money. That's true. And a lot of them spend it on methamphetamines. It is a huge problem in the gas and oil industry. They work 12 hours on, 12 hours off. And sometimes when that 12 hours is over and your relief is supposed to show up, they don't. So you have to keep going.
And you see other things too. You'll see poaching incidents by drill rigs, you know, people getting busted for that.
The destruction of roads is a big thing in Garfield County. You get these roads that were initially designed to be farm-to-market roads, and now they're experiencing heavy truck traffic 24/7.
Yeah, there have been fatal accidents, you know, industry people dying, motors being run off the road, you know, that, through whose fault, I don't know, but the truck traffic's there, and it's resulted in accidents and spills.
How do you like our bridge?
It didn't look like that last year.
That's from heavy drilling rigs and support rigs like Halliburton. It takes, I counted one time, 37 large semis went across that bridge to fracture one well.
The difference between holding up a 6,000 or 8,000 pound pickup and a 100,000 pound truck, somewhere around 18, 20 inches of fill and 2 or 3 inches extra asphalt.
We're using our good construction gravel that as a builder, I know we're going to need for decades into the future. And we are squandering all of that good, high-quality river basin gravel to build roads and pads to drill gas wells with. Now, that gravel's not going to be reclaimed. It's not going to be brought back and brought back into our economy. It's gone. All of these things taken in sum make for an impact that is for many people unbearable.
They don't care. They're making so much money. Money has corrupted everything from our government to everything that's going on. It's the money thing. Nobody cares about the lives of the people. This is my life. I'm 62 years old, and I'm not going to have a lot more life, and they're going to destroy my retirement.
There are people who are growing fat on the wealth of the gas and oil industry. Many of them not here, but there are quite a few here who are business people whose businesses are thriving and they are expanding and growing as much as they can, making money faster than they know how to spend it. Wonderful for them. But why should anybody subsidize that success? If you check in Garfield County and you check in Weld County and La Plata County, and as the industry has continued to move through areas and expand and grow, the list of losers continues to grow.
Curtis Meekum, who lives across the way from the Pond Leasing Group, he tried to sell. He couldn't give it away.
I've sold it. I've tried to sell it several times. There have been several people that would have bought this, and I can back that up if it hadn't been for that disposal pond.
businesses that had to go under because they couldn't find enough employees to stay in business because the gas and oil industry has absolutely sucked up our labor pool. Our police departments are strained to the limit because we have considerably more violence than we had. We have more drug problems than we've had in the past.
And then some of our biggest concerns locally are what's it doing to the surrounding environment?
Right out here, we have protected toads. That don't matter. We have protected flora. That don't matter. We have the sage grouse, which is a protected fowl. That don't matter. The fowl are really suffering. The sage grouse is suffering because of the noise. They can't reproduce. Our wild horse area, that don't matter.
Our air quality, our water quality. We've had some people who have had their health impacted.
Laura Amos, who had a very famous case in which she developed an adrenal tumor that was is connected to a specific chemical that causes this specific tumor in the adrenal gland. It's very rare. She developed it after a fracking job ruined their well.
When they create a well in Garfield County, they use fracturing fluids. So they take, quite frankly, a big toxic cocktail, millions and millions of gallons of it, and inject it under high pressure underground.
It's forcing down fluid underground to kind of break up the sandstone formations or sand in the fluid to kind of prop up the individual grains of sand, as I understand it, in the formation and to get the gas to flow.
They don't tell you what's in fracking fluid. They're exempt from the Safe Drinking Water Act. They know fully well that their hydraulic fracturing process pollutes groundwater. It happens frequently.
There are over 32,000 wells in the state, and there are only 19 field inspectors.
There was a driller and his team who came here to work who finally packed up and left. He was asked, why? Why are you leaving? You know, the boom is just starting. And he said, I have drilled over 200 wells here in the last year and a half. And he said, I've never had an inspector on the site. And he said, and they're making me use chemicals I don't want to be exposed to, and I don't want my men to be exposed to. We're leaving. He said, we're getting out of here. I wanted to believe industry when they said we only use water, guar gum, and soap to drill. And we had no way to disprove this until there was a blowout in Wyoming, and they were only drilling. It was a directional drilling. They got down to about 8,000 feet when all of a sudden they hit a high pressure area. And the next thing they knew, west of the well, in the area around it, they began to get little mini geysers, and material was coming up. And there was a road quite near this, and the road cuts, this stuff kept coming up out of the ground, and methane gas, and lots of fluid, and ran down the road. And the people living in the area, there was a housing development nearby, couldn't go out their doors, and they complained. The odor was just impossible. And so the local officials were able to get from the company that was drilling the MSDSs for the materials that they were using, and they immediately FedExed them to us. And then we went right to our database, and we're able to then go through and look at the products. Some of them were different, some of them were some that we had already, but we were able to go in and break it out and look at the health pattern. So, of course, that blew this myth that basically drilling is safe. So we know that drilling is also introducing a tremendous amount of chemicals just through that process of getting the hole in the ground.
In visiting with somebody just Saturday from the Rifle area, she said from the air, the land is just crisscrossed with roads now. There's a cloud of dust in the valley from the air. Simply, she said there's, you know, who knows whether it's smog or dust, but it's probably a lot of it is dust. So there's roads being built, crisscrossing property, wells that in some time past could only be put in on one well per 60 acres or something. That has been compromised down to where you can have wells much closer. She said there's people who turn on their water and they can light it with a match. And she said the whole valley stinks.
If you talk to people they'll say, well, I see smog when I look over the parachute, and went, you know, you never saw that 5 years ago. So I mean, there's kind of an anecdotal feeling of that there's regional air quality impacts, which even here in Glenwood without drilling rigs being downwind, there's concern here about that.
We have production pits, which when they're drilling a well, they have an open pit, and they get a flow back of this drilling mud, of the fracking fluids, also of any liquid hydrocarbons that are underground as well, which in the natural gas business they call condensate. And those things flow back along with produced water, which is highly saline. Now, sometimes they take this and they truck it off and process it somewhere, but a lot of times it's just left in the pit to evaporate. And there are just numbers and numbers of Oil and Gas Commission files with spills of produced water into the river, or spills of condensate into the river or on roadways or in pads. And I have a video that I can provide you with of a fire at a well just south of Silt this past year in March, and it was just a monstrosity, flames reaching 200 feet high at least.
That's always been a concern, and to what degree is a small town fire department, you know, really, does it have the equipment and the knowledge to respond to these? It's been a safety concern.
When you hear an oil and gas company testify that they want to do their operations the correct way, and they want to respect, you know, the health and well-being and environmental issues that the local citizens are concerned about, what's your reaction to that?
They're lying. Everyone else comes in. That's what you ask when they come in the door is, oh, are you the ones going to lie today?
You should know, and everybody else who lives anywhere on top of a gas field should know, that the two most important words that you will ever hear from a gas man is for now.
For now.
For now. This is what we want. For now. We're not going to tell you what we may come back and ask you later.
There are many different land use impacts and public health potential impacts, environmental impacts that can occur when you bring heavy industry into a rural, residential, or agricultural area.
What we discovered for Colorado basically are that there are 171 products that we now know are in use, and that they have 245 chemicals in them. 91% of the chemicals in use had at least one health effect. So, and then the 9% for which we had, that had no health effects, does not mean they didn't have any health effect. Either there was no information on the chemical, or we were told that a chemical was proprietary. Also, what we discovered was that 35% of the products contain endocrine disruptors, which was much to our surprise. An endocrine disruptor is a chemical that interferes with the endocrine system. Now, the endocrine system actually involves parts of the brain that most people don't even realize. The control center for the endocrine system is in the brain, the hypothalamus, the pituitary, but it includes the thyroid glands. It's not only the sex organs. Then you've got the pancreas that produces insulin. Insulin is a hormone. The endocrine system basically is a very, very sensitive system that controls how a baby is constructed. It's how a baby gets programmed before it's born, so how it will function and behave and think later on in life. And they operate at very, very low concentrations, in the range of about a part per trillion. So when industry tells us that we shouldn't worry, that it's only in our water at a very low concentration, or it's only in our air at such a low concentration, they have not taken into consideration, and they haven't looked to find out what these chemicals can do to that developing baby in a pregnant woman, and to our children as they're maturing, and to some very, very sensitive people as they mature later in life. Huge, huge compressor sitting there. Big compressors, 500 horsepower, 1,500 horsepower compressors that run, remember, 24 hours a day. You don't dare let that pressure reduce. You've got to keep this thing pumping. So they're burning tremendous amount of diesel, to keep these things going. Diesel, when you burn it, and gasoline produce nitrogen oxides. So you've got the nitrogen oxides going up, you've got the VOCs escaping from this equipment, and that, when it gets up in the air in the presence of sunlight, produces ozone. One molecule of ozone gets into the lungs, into the very deep alveolar tissue, that very moist, flexible tissue in the lung where your oxygen and carbon dioxide are exchanged. This is what keeps us alive. If ozone gets in there, it'll burn a hole in that tissue. Over the years, this leads to all kinds of respiratory problems, asthma, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. It also makes you more susceptible to adult pulmonary disorders that so many people are exposed or basically have today. Ozone is very hard on trees. Leaves, pine needles, gets into the stomata and burns the stomata. And so that you see forests begin to decline. Production of fruit trees, alfalfa, crops. Basically, once that ozone level gets above 40 parts per billion, and this hasn't changed over the years, they have shown you begin to see a decrease in production in the crop. Ozone plumes extend over 200 miles. And so, and it may not even, there may not even be as much ozone right over where these things are going into the air. They have to go up into the air and cook. But as that air mass is moving to the northeast, the general flow, that's where you're going to begin to see the damage.
Last year, the Air Quality Control Commission at the state passed a new rule on VOC, or volatile organic compound emissions, from well operations or gas, natural gas operations in the statewide area. Some of the readings last year showed levels that really pushed the EPA's national threshold.
Every one of those compressors, dehydrators, well pads, pumps that you see that are making it possible for us to get the gas, so all those delivery systems to get the gas to us, are also releasing what they call fugitive gases, very dangerous gases, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, xylene, as well as methane. The fugitive methane that's coming off of these operations is enough to create tons of what we call VOCs in our air every day. You can't see them. Most of them you can't smell. But they're there. And they do have harmful effects.
On the air emissions, you know, a lot of it also, there's still the issues of the people who live right close to a drilling rig or a well, or you know, some of these facilities. It's, you might not be personally affected if you're miles away, but you can be pretty personally affected if your bedroom is right next to something where you're smelling things.
Some people have very severe immediate effects. Blinding, they just can't see anything. They lose their vision, they get severe headaches, they get sore throats, they feel dizzy, they get sick. Some people have fainted. They feel loss of control, motor control. Some people begin to get spasms. The long-term, I would say, delayed, repeated exposure leads to such things as neuropathy, where people cannot use their extremities. They lose the control and the strength in their hands. They have pain. At the same time, apparently, there's an immune response that kicks in as well. So you begin to get this autoimmune type of thing, where so many of the people who have been living over in that area that we've spoken to, and in Canada, in Alberta, Alabama, it isn't like we're looking just in one spot now because we're trying to find out, is this the only place where it's happened? The people develop multiple sensitivity to chemicals, which is irreversible. It leads to fatigue. Remember, chronic fatigue syndrome, that sort of thing. Also, it actually, there are some people who definitely feel now that they don't function as well mentally. They can't remember things, short-term memory, long-term memory, and it's very disturbing to those people who are affected. But they pose a puzzle also to the medical community. We've got to figure out how we use these products where people aren't exposed to them, or people are only exposed to them because they want to be. And that's the difference with what we're dealing with in the gas industry. They're releasing a lot of volatile chemicals. They're releasing soluble chemicals that can get into our water that we didn't ask for and we don't want. They're violating your personal environment, your personal area. And I don't know how we solve that problem.
You know, wherever that drill pad is going to be located, there's going to be surface disturbances associated with it, and that's going to impact whatever the vegetation community is, and then subsequently that's going to impact, you know, the animal and plant community. So, you know, if it's in the wetland, it's going to have impacts to the wetland community integrity and structure. If it's in the terrestrial habitat, it's going to have an impact to that terrestrial plant community, to those terrestrial animal species.
Roads, development, construction projects, disturbances serve as conduits for weeds and invasive plants and the insects that follow. And so that areas that otherwise would be relatively isolated and potentially weed-free because there's very little access by road or other recreationists or whatever, once you put that disturbance in a long strip like a road or a pipeline, you go out and walk those, they're covered with weeds, and thus those weeds now have access to much greater area than just the narrow strip that represents the pipeline or the road. If weeds actually take over and predominate over your native vegetation, you completely change the structure of the vegetation when things grow, how much cover there is on the ground, so erosion control, what goes into our rivers, and then what wildlife can make use of that area. If it becomes, you know, cheatgrass or other weeds, rather than a nice diverse sagebrush shrubland, you've really limited what native birds, including sage grouse, can make use of the area.
Yeah. There's a very big concern for us with the integrity of the landscape. And as John mentioned earlier, we have what we call our B ranks, how we rank our sites on that scale of 1 to 5. One being irreplaceable site. If we lose that site, there's a good chance that we will lose species that are found no place else in the world. And although the sites that we're talking about today on the refuge are not at that irreplaceable level, they're not what we call a B1. They're at the B2 and B3 categories. What is really critical to remember is just downstream, if you will, the Great Sand Dunes area is a B1 site for us. It's an irreplaceable site. And we have approximately 30 of those in the state of Colorado. That if we lose those sites, we stand to lose species that are found no place else in the world. And so Colorado is responsible for protecting those sites. Great Sand Dunes, like I said, is one of those sites. And it's a B1 site for multiple reasons, but the primary reason is because of the 6 or 7 endemic insects that are found there and no place else. And they are tightly associated with the sands. And those sands are tightly associated with groundwater. What happens if the groundwater is impacted? And we said you can impact the water on the Baca Ranch, but the true impact might be on the Great Sand Dunes. And that's our irreplaceable site. So we have to remember at a landscape level to look beyond where we're at and what's the impact much further away. Is there a big impact? If there is, we should know about it. And I highly recommend that all of us think about the impacts to the Great Sand Dunes and if there is an impact. And if there is, how we mitigate it.
people are so concerned about the long-term water quality impact, which is very, very serious. We're being deprived of potable water because potable water is being used to drill. They can't drill with dirty water. They have to take good, clean water in order to drill a well. That's extremely important. We're also contaminating water because we are adding contaminated water that's coming up from underground into our systems, either by letting it sit on the ground and evaporate, which then goes up into the air, or possible leaks, seepage, and we have problems where there have been leaks.
There was the big seep south of Silt, like in 2004, I believe, where methane gas bubbled up to the surface, and there were concerns about it getting into domestic water supplies. And obviously, that's, you know, that's kind of like the worst nightmare for these people. What they've always worried about is that kind of thing happening. And
there have been what is called blowouts, where when they have drilled underground, they hit a high-pressure area. They're not prepared to deal with that, and the material that they've been drilling underground and everything else that's down there comes back up as well. So you get a lot of methane, you get a lot of petroleum products that come up that are very harmful, and you also get a lot of contaminated water.
By and large, supposedly it shouldn't happen then. The gas formations are way down here, and the domestic water supplies are near the surface up here, but through faulty drilling practices or failure to fully understand the geology, that managed to occur.
My water here, both on this piece of property and my 160 acres, is all artesian. If that were contaminated, I'd have to leave. And I realize most drillers are going to say, you know, we'll do everything we can to keep from contaminating the water. Once it's contaminated, it is.
We live on these threads of water. And if much more happens along the edge of the Colorado River or those feeder streams into the Colorado River or the Rio Grande, for one, we're going to see serious problems. We don't have the technology today to get a lot of the chemicals out of the water at the concentrations that we need to now.
It wasn't more than 7 years ago in Garfield County when our spacing went from, you know, evolved from 640-acre spacing to what it is today, which is 40-acre spacing with 10-acre downhole spacing. So we have grown in a very short time to what I believe is a density that makes it difficult to be compatible with rural residential areas and agricultural areas, wildlife migration routes, winter ranges, all of those opportunities that rural Colorado lends to the environment.
Most people here moved here for kind of a peaceful, quiet mountain existence, and certainly it's been a level of industrialization that's left a lot of people, with an unease about it and also a concern about how far it could spread and whether it could affect them someday.
And unfortunately, if they find good gas in your region, you will become a center hub also.
If they strike gas, what do they need to do? That's the most likely thing that they're going to find down there, methane. Well, you can't put wellhead gas straight into a pipeline. It will corrode the insides of the pipeline out and nothing flat, and plus the pumps that are needed to move the gas. So you have to clean up the liquid hydrocarbons in it, the condensates, the sulfuric acid, all sorts of things, and that requires a surface plant called a gas processing plant to get the gas sweet enough and clean enough that you can put it in a pipeline in the national grid.
quantum physics tells us now that you can't observe a phenomenon without altering that phenomenon. So you don't have to go much further to think about, well, can we scrape this whole thing off and then replant it and call it the same?
The recovery, it depends on what do we want it to be. It will recover. It's not necessarily going to recover to something that we want. If we want is something with a high abundance and high diversity of native plant species, native pollinators doing what needs to be done, and a wide variety of birds and small mammals and large mammals, then that, if once we put up fences and developed around it, then it takes management, it takes purpose, and it takes money, and it takes people, and it takes time. But as far as getting native vegetation back, we don't have people who are pushing that right now, and it's hard to do, and it's going to fail a large number of times, just because you need, the number of people, the intensity of getting the right seed on the ground at the right time, and then hoping that the right precipitation and the right climate conditions happen during the upcoming year. And since you can't count on any of those things, it's hard to make it work. One of the things we're running into out here is you don't know what you're losing because you don't know what's there. And if you don't know precisely what's there, you may have no idea that you've ever lost it. And why?
Anybody that is going to look at developing their land, whether it's a private landowner or whether it's a wildlife refuge or whether it's any kind of, it really doesn't matter who owns the land. The right thing to do is to inventory what you have on that land, figure out what's the most sensitive, what's the most critical, what's the most unique, figure out what you really want to protect and how you're going to protect it. And for those areas that are incredibly unique or biologically critical, then the easiest thing to do is to try to avoid any development on that area. Anytime you have to deviate from that, then you really have to start asking serious questions. What are the impacts, and how do we mitigate for those impacts? Mm-hmm. And that management plan should guide your development processes.
And I think one of the critical aspects of any, when you're talking about trying to get together regulations for any type of development whatsoever, I think an important aspect of it is what is the acceptable density of that development to you and to the groups that are engaged in that discussion. I think that's the huge part, is what density are we willing to accept? And what, at that level of density, what are going to be the impact to whatever it is you're concerned about, whether it's natural resources, biological resources, or cultural resources?
All of the refuge, the Sangre de Cristos, all that intact landscape from a coarse filter approach comes out as an important site. And the Nature Conservancy and others have conducted an ecoregional plan that they did exactly that. They asked, where are the sites that need to be incorporated so that we don't lose any of our biodiversity, not just our rare biodiversity, but all of our biodiversity. And the San Luis Valley and the Baca Ranch and the refuge and the sand dunes all come out as a critical part for that coarse filter. Well, the highest protection, without knowing anything else, the easiest, highest protection is to say no to development. That's the safe. There's no question that's the safe way to do it. It's just to say no. We understand that there's a lot of push. So I think you really do need to put together a management plan. You need to put together a group of scientists. You need to put together a group of local citizens and stakeholders and try to get at those answers. Right. And try to get at the answers from the developer's point of view is how much do they need and how much do we need to protect? And can we take areas and protect them in their entirety so that we don't have to worry about restoration? Well, can we take other areas and let development take place on those, and restoration has to be part of those places, but it is the second choice, not the first choice.
In the year 2000, the Rifle was a community of 6,700 people. Today, we're right around 9,000. The state demographer has done a study of our area, our community, has indicated that by the year 2025 to 2030, we will be a community of between 30 and 40,000 people because of primarily the energy extractive industries that are in the area. It's an onslaught of workforce, both for the primary industry, which is the extractive industry, and secondly, because of the ancillary businesses that have come in to support and the ancillary workforce. For example, I mean, with new population, you have to have new teachers, you have to have new hospital employees, you have to have new police force, new policemen, you have to have new fire people, you know, so all of the business, you have to have new people in the grocery stores. We're growing, and we're growing rapidly. Our infrastructure is taxed to the max. We're looking at, in the city of Rifle right now, between $67 and $68 million worth of infrastructure needs in the next 5 years. And it's because of the new increased population. The infrastructure is funded by us, the city of Rifle.
Severance taxes given back to local communities based on right now where the employees live, where the employees that are working for the industry live. So if they don't live in Crestone, and none of them do, Crestone won't get any money. If they don't live in Sawatch County, they won't get any money. Nothing. They will have to sustain the impacts, but they won't get any money.
The industry has contributed to hospitals and college expansions and so forth. So there's a lot of wealth, but then there's also a question, well, how much of that was needed because the schools have more kids in the classes because the industry's here, and you know, Rifle's economy is growing, but now it's got to deal with the new sewer plant and other impacts, and it'll argue that it's, for all the revenues it's seeing, it's got major expenses that it can't keep up with.
I'll be the first to admit our sales tax revenues are higher today than they ever have been in the history of the city. If our existing revenues when we first started this whole extractive process in the area were down here, our revenues are now here, but our needs are up here.
Forget what our latest count is, but a couple thousand, several thousand wells in our county, and before it's all over, we're going to have tens of thousands of wells. So there's first just getting our minds around that just how big this thing could be, first off.
I don't think anybody's going to be particularly glad to see more big trucks, more dust. I mean, there's a lot of commerce going on with the agriculture, and that's pretty well about all our highways can handle. And having big truckloads of things going in and out. A dustier valley's not going to please anyone. The funneling away of water is not going to be anything that people will embrace.
There is the concern of to what degree the energy industry may kind of contribute to kind of permanently changing what this county is like and maybe taking away from some of its current special values.
How much can the subterranean system assimilate and not eventually have it come back to the surface? It's very difficult. I mean, it's very difficult for anyone to conceive, but you have to sit and think about the volumes that are going in. 28 fracs on a well pad. None of those fracs are more than 1,000 feet away in one direction or another. They are little mini explosions, and they say that in their literature. They describe it as that. What is it doing to that whole area there? I just can't conceive that there aren't going to be some major accidents.
And there's also the aesthetic aspect. You know, how much are we willing to accept as a society in as far as degradation of the landscape?
That was an excerpt of the documentary Rural Impact on what hydrofracking has done to Colorado. Find out how to take action against this horror at shaleshock.org and toxicstargeting.com.
The Doom That Came to Sarnath by H.P. Lovecraft. There's in the land of Minar a vast still lake that is fed by no stream and out of which no stream flows. 10,000 years ago, there stood by its shore the mighty city of Sarnath, but Sarnath stands there no more. It is told that in the immemorial years when the world was young, before ever the men of Sarnath came to the land of Minar, another city stood beside the lake, the gray stone city of Ib, which was old as the lake itself, and peopled with beings not pleasing to behold. Very odd and ugly were these beings, as indeed are most beings of a world yet inchoate and rudely fashioned. It is written on the brick cylinders of Kedatheron that the beings of Ib were in hue as green as the lake and the mists that rise above it. They had bulging eyes, pouting, flabby lips, and curious ears, and were without voice. It is also written that they descended one night from the moon in a mist, they and the vast still lake and gray stone city Ib. However this may be, it is certain that they worshipped a sea-green stone idol, chiseled in the likeness of Bokrog, the great water lizard, before which they danced horribly when the moon was gibbous. And it is written in the papyrus of Ilarnik that they one day discovered fire, and thereafter kindled flames on many ceremonial occasions. But not much is written of these beings, because they lived in very ancient times, and man is young and knows little of the very ancient living things. After many eons, men came to the land of Minar, dark shepherd folk, with their fleecy flocks, who built Thra, Ilarnik, and Kedatheron on the winding river Eye. And certain tribes, more hardy than the rest, pushed to the border of the lake and built Sarnath, at a point where precious metals were found in the earth. Not far from the great city of Ib did the wandering tribes lay the first stones of Sarnath, and at the beings of Ib they marveled greatly. But with their marveling was mixed hate, for they thought it not meet that beings of such aspect should walk about the world of men at dusk. Nor did they like the strange sculptures upon the gray monoliths of Ib, for why these sculptures lingered so late in the world, even until the coming of men, none can tell, unless it was because the land of Minar is very still, and remote from most other lands, both of waking and of dream. As the men of Sarnath beheld more of the beings of Ib, their hate grew, and it was not less because they found the beings weak and soft as jelly to the touch of stones and arrows. So one day the young warriors, the slingers, and the spearmen, and the bowmen marched against Ib and slew all inhabitants thereof, pushing the queer bodies into the lake with long spears because they did not wish to touch them. And because they did not like the gray sculptured monoliths of Ib, they cast these also into the lake, wondering from the greatness of the labor, however the stones were brought from afar, as they must have been, since there is naught like them in the land of Minar, or in the lands adjacent. Thus of the very ancient city of Ib was nothing spared, save the sea-green stone idol chiseled in the likeness of Bokrog the water lizard. This the young warriors took back with them as a symbol of conquest over the old gods and beings of the, and as the sign of leadership in Minar. But on the night after it was set up in the temple, a terrible thing must have happened, for weird lights were seen over the lake, and in the morning the people found the idol gone, and the high priest Tarnish lying dead, as from some fear unspeakable, and before he died, Tarnish had scrawled upon the altar of chrysolite, with coarse shaky strokes, the sign of doom. After Tarnish, there were many high priests in Sarnath, but never was the sea-green stone idol found. And many centuries came and went, wherein Sarnath prospered exceedingly, so that only priests and old women remembered what Tarnish had scrawled upon the altar of chrysolite. Betwixt Cernoth and the city of Alarnac arose a caravan route, and the precious metals from the earth were exchanged for other metals, and rare cloths and jewels and books and tools for artificers, and all things of luxury that are known to people who dwell along the winding river Eye and beyond. So Cernoth waxed mighty and learned and beautiful, and set forth conquering armies to subdue the neighboring cities, and in time there sate upon the throne in Cernoth the kings of all the land of Manar and of many lands adjacent. The wonder of the world and the pride of all mankind was Cernoth the Magnificent. Of polished desert quarried marble were its walls, in height 300 cubits and in breadth 75, so that chariots might pass each other as men drove them along the top. For full 500 stadia they did run, being open not only on the side towards the lake, where a sea-green stone wall kept back the waves that rose oddly once a year at the festival of the destroying of Ib. In Cernoth were 50 streets from the lake to the gates of the caravans, and 50 more intersecting them. With onyx they were paved, save those whereon the horses and camels and elephants trod, which were paved with granite. And the gates of Cernoth were as many as the landward ends of the streets, each of bronze, and flanked by the figures of lions and elephants, carven from some stone no longer among men. The houses of Cernoth were glazed brick and chalcedony, each having its walled garden and crystal lakelet. With strange art they were builded, for no other city had houses like them, and travelers from Thra and Alarnac and Cathedron marveled at the shining domes whereon they were surmounted. But more marvelous still were the palaces and the temples and the gardens made by Zakhar, the olden king. There were many palaces, the last of which were mightier than any in Thra or Alarnac or Cathedron. So high were they that one within might sometimes fancy himself beneath only the sky. Yet when lighted with torches dipped in the oil of Dothar, their walls showed vast paintings of kings and armies, of a splendor at once inspiring and stupefying to the beholder. Many were the pillars of the palaces, all of tinted marble, and carven into designs of surpassing beauty. And in most of the palaces, the floors were mosaics of beryl and lapis lazuli and sardonyx and carbuncle and other choice materials so disposed that the beholder might fancy himself walking over beds of the rarest flowers. And there were likewise fountains which cast scented waters about in pleasing jets arranged with cunning art. Outshining all others was the palace of the kings of Manar and of the lands adjacent. On a pair of golden crouching lions rested the throne, many steps above the gleaming floor. And it was wrought of one piece of ivory, though no man lives who knows whence so vast a piece could have come. In that palace there were so many galleries, and many amphitheaters where lions and men and elephants battled at the pleasure of the kings. Sometimes the amphitheaters were flooded with water, conveyed from the lake in mighty aqueducts, and then were enacted stirring sea fights or combats betwixt swimmers and deadly marine beings. Lofty and amazing were the 17 tower-like temples of Cernoth, fashioned of a bright multicolored stone not known elsewhere. A full 1,000 cubits high stood the greatest among them, wherein the high priest dwelt with a magnificence scarce less than that of the kings. On the ground were halls as vast and splendid as those of the palaces, where gathered throngs in worship of Zokalar and Tamash and Loban, the chief gods of Cernoth, whose incense-enveloped shrines were as the thrones of monarchs. Not like the ikens of other gods were those of Zokalar and Tamash and Loban, for so close to life were they that one might swear the graceful bearded gods themselves sate on the ivory thrones. And up unending steps of Zircon was the tower chamber, where from the high priest looked out over the city and the plains and the lake by day, and at the cryptic moon and significant stars and planets, and the reflections in the lake at night. Here was done the very secret and ancient rite in detestation of Bokrok the water lizard, and here rested the altar of chrysolite, which bore the doom scroll of Tarnish. Wonderful likewise were the gardens made by Zakhar, the olden king. In the center of Sarnath they lay, covering a great space and encircled by a high wall. And they were surmounted by a mighty dome of glass, through which shone the sun and moon and planets when it was clear, and from which hung fulgent images of the sun and the moon and stars and planets when it was not clear. In summer the gardens were cooled with fresh odorous breezes, skillfully wafted by fans, and in winter they were heated with concealed fires, so that in those gardens it was always spring. There ran little streams over bright pebbles, dividing meads of green and gardens of many hues, and spanned by a multitude of bridges. Many were the waterfalls in their courses, and many were the huge lakelets into which they expanded. Over the streams and lakelets rode white swans, whilst the music of rare birds chimed in with the melody of the waters. In ordered terraces rose the green banks, adorned here and there with bowers of vines and sweet blossoms, and seats and benches of marble and porphyry. And there were many small shrines and temples where one might rest or pray to small gods. Each year there was celebrated in Sarnath the feast of the destroying of Ib, at which time wine, song, dancing, and merriment of every kind abounded. Great honors were then paid to the shades of those who had annihilated the odd ancient beings, and the memory of those beings and their elder gods was derided by dancers and lutenists, crowned with roses from the gardens of Zakhar, and the kings would look out over the lake and curse the bones of the dead that lay beneath it. At first the high priest liked not these festivals, for there had descended amongst them queer tales of how the sea-green Echion had vanished, and how Tar and Ish had died from fear and left a warning, and they said that from their high tower they sometimes saw lights beneath the waters of the lake. But as many years passed without calamity, even the priests laughed and cursed and joined in the orgies of the feasters. Indeed, had they not themselves in the high tower often performed the very ancient and secret rite in detestation of Bakrog the water lizard? And a thousand years of riches and delight passed over Sarnath, wonder of the world. Gorgeous beyond thought was the feast of the thousandth year of the destroying of Ib. For a decade it had been talked about in the land of Manar, and as it drew nigh, there came to Sarnath on horses and camels and elephants men from Thra, Alarnac, and Cathadron, and all the cities of Manar and the lands beyond. Before the marble walls on the appointed night were pitched the pavilions of princes and the tents of travelers. Within his banquet hall reclined Nargis Hay, the king, drunken with ancient wine from the faults of conquered Panath, and surrounded by feasting nobles and hurrying slaves. There were eaten many strange delicacies at their feast. Peacocks from the distant hills of Limpan, heels of camels from the Basnic Desert, nuts and spices from the Sedarian groves, and pearls from wave-washed metal dissolved in the vinegar of Thra. Of sauces there were an untold number, prepared by the subtlest cooks in all Manar, and suited to the palate of every feaster. But most prized of all the viands were the great fishes from the lake, each of vast size, and served upon golden platters set with rubies and diamonds. Whilst the king and his nobles feasted within the palace and viewed the crowning dish as it awaited them on golden platters, others feasted elsewhere. In the tower of the great temple the priests held revels, and in pavilions without the walls the princes of neighboring lands made merry. And it was the high priest, Nika, who first saw the shadows that descended from the gibbous moon into the lake, and the damnable green mist that rose from the lake to meet the moon and to shroud in a sinister haze the towers of the domes of faded Sarnath. Thereafter those in the towers and without the walls beheld strange lights on the water, and saw that the grey rock Acurion, which was wont to rear high above it near the shore, was almost submerged. And fear grew vaguely yet swiftly, so that the princes of Ilarnac and of Far Rakol took down and folded their tents and pavilions and departed, though they scarce knew the reason for their departing. Then, close to the hour of midnight, all the bronze gates of Sarnath burst open and emptied forth a frenzied throng that blackened the plain, so that all the visiting princes and travelers fled away in fright, for on the faces of this throng was writ a madness born of horror unendurable, and on the tongues were words so terrible that no hearer paused for proof. Men whose eyes were wild with fear shrieked loud at the sight within the king's banquet hall, where through the windows were seen no longer the forms of Nargisai and his nobles and slaves, but a horde of indescribable green, voiceless things with bulging eyes, pouting, flabby lips, and curious ears, things which danced horribly, bearing in their paws golden platters set with rubies and diamonds, and containing uncouth flames. And the princes and travelers, as they fled from the doomed city of Sarnath on horses and camels and elephants, looked again upon the misbeginning lake, and saw the great rock Acherion was quite submerged. Through all the land of Manar and the land adjacent spread the tales of those who had fled from Sarnath, and caravans sought that accursed city and its precious metals no more. It was long ere any travelers went thither, and even then only the brave and adventurous young men of yellow hair and blue eyes, who were no kin to the men of Manar. These men indeed went to the lake to view Sarnath, but though they found the vast still lake itself and the grey rock Acherion which rears high above it near the shore, they beheld not the wonder of the world and pride of all mankind. Where once had risen walls of 300 cubits and towers yet higher, now stretched only the marshy shore, and where once had dwelt 50 million of men, now crawled the detestable water lizard. Not even the mines of precious metal remained. Doom had come to Sarnath. But half buried in the rushes was spied a curious green idol, an exceedingly ancient idol chiseled in the likeness of Bokrog, the great water lizard. That idol, enshrined in the high temple at Ilarnik, was subsequently worshipped beneath the gibbous moon throughout the land of Manar. The end of The Doom That Came to Sarnath by H.P. Lovecraft.
Well, I woke up last Sunday morning wondering why my brain was mourning about the political songwriting scene. Ha! Well, I thought and thought till my brain was aching, then I ran into the kitchen shrieking, why the hell don't people know what's going on? So I sat down with my cup of tea and the Sunday paper so's I could see if there was anything that resembled the blessed truth. Well, there was science, sports, and business news, entertainment, and book reviews, but coverage of the world was mighty thin. And the content of world events was what politicians represent in the editorialist's propaganda op-ed piece. To learn more, folks would have to dig and read books that aren't too glib and obscure magazines that dig for dirt. And that requires lots of extra work, and extra work is what we like to shirk. And besides, you might really learn what's going on. Then you'd likely get a bit depressed or dedicated to social unrest, and you might even try to overthrow someone. So it's better to sit back, relax. Don't strain your brain with too many facts. Skim the front page and move on over to sports. Try the comics or the film reviews. Don't even look at the business news. That's just for folks who own the stocks and bonds. And then relax with a cool, foamy beer. Remember the holidays almost here. The Leafs are gonna play somewhere today. Shania's got a new CD to play.